This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, April 1st, 2024. I'm Caleb Brown. War may be the health of the state, but crisis is regularly how government grows. Abigail Hall is a professor of economics at the University of Tampa. We discussed last month in Texas her work attempting to get at a good measure of the growth of government during times of crisis and why that expansion of government isn't always easily captured by pages of regulation or federal spending. Many economists are familiar with the concept of the ratchet effect. This is largely comes from the work of the great Robert Higgs. Hello, Robert. I hope you're listening. If you don't mind, just characterize what that is. Just give me a clear, clean definition of what the ratchet effect is and why it's worth understanding it.
Sure. So the ratchet effect is a framework for understanding growth in government. And it's important for potentially understanding growth in terms of the scale of government, so the size of government, but also scope, so the type of activities in which government is involved. So the basic elements of the framework are the following. You have some government growth that's occurring for a variety of different reasons. There are lots of different theories of government growth. But in this framework, there is some kind of crisis that occurs. And as a result of that crisis, there is this push or this call for government to do something to get rid of or to otherwise temper the crisis. Government, as a result, expands in scale and scope. Over time, the crisis abates, and government does reduce some of the activities that it started engaging in as a result of this crisis. But in this framework, and what Higgs points out, is that it never quite goes back down to that original pre-crisis trend. And so you're left with a potentially permanently larger sized government.
And so when people talk about this in shorthand, they usually reductio to spending, which is when we're measuring this, we're only looking at the dollars that are committed to X, Y, and Z. Is that fair?
Oftentimes when people are analyzing or using this framework, they've had a tendency to focus on things like the fiscal size of government, which is understandable because most people using this framework are other economists who are comfortable doing empirical or quantitative analyses. Now, my co-author, Chris Coyne, and I, who's on this working paper, but also in other places, we've been really explicit in our attempts to work on the other margin in which this framework also applies, which is scope.
When people are counting up regulations at the federal level, for example, it's very easy to just use pages of the Federal Register as your proxy for the size or scope of government regulation. Now, people who've ever read a government regulation realize that a very short regulation might have sweeping effects, and a long and detailed regulation might not.
That's absolutely correct. And I'm familiar with that research that looks and uses the Federal Register as a proxy for scope. And I appreciate the work that that's trying to do, but I think the problem is exactly what you've identified. We can imagine a very small government or a very small, as you mentioned on paper, piece of regulation that is very broad in its scope, while simultaneously, and anyone who's ever taught students will know, I can read 20 pages and might not encounter a lot of content or a lot of power in this case in those pages.
When trying to get at that scope, it's not just a dollar figure on a piece of paper. Oh, I imagine it would have to be a much more nuanced and careful analysis to try to get at that, getting some measure of scope.
You have to take a different methodological approach to really, I think, get at issues related to scope. It requires a much more detailed historical understanding in many cases for looking at, well, what did things look like, and for using the ratchet effect prior to a crisis, post-crisis, and looking at, okay, well, what exactly has changed and how has it changed over time? So you're not looking at things that have or would come with, even under best case scenarios, a comprehensive large data set that, say, economists could use to effectively analyze scope.
So you look at nuclear weapons.
Yes.
And that tremendous destructive capacity, but in terms of like their costs to build, not as much.
Yeah, we actually don't, in this particular paper, engage the cost figures really at all. What we're attempting to do in this paper is two things. So we expand the original framework of the ratchet effect, which initially, at least in the way that Higgs conceptualizes it, there is one crisis. But one of the things that we've observed throughout our work, and other people have pointed this out too in discussing the framework, often there's not just one crisis. There might be successive crises, or a crisis might continue for a long time. So we attempt to augment the framework, and we use nuclear weapons as an example to explain how this would work in what we refer to as secondary or compounded crises. And the other thing that we do too is we also attempt to bring in some of the other elements of this framework that are often underappreciated, particularly in Crisis and Leviathan, where Higgs first really develops this framework. He discusses the importance of ideology with respect to the ratchet effect taking hold, but also mentions ideology as a constraint. And so we use that to explain the non-use of nuclear weapons after 1945, as well as help to explain the drawdown of U.S. nuclear arsenals toward the end of the Cold War and beyond.
So with all that in mind, how do you get at answering the question of the scope of government with respect to nuclear weapons?
So what we attempt to do is we are taking a deep dive in looking at understanding U.S. nuclear weapons policy and mapping it onto this expanded framework that we've developed to account again for these multiple crises. Within the context of nuclear weapons, those two crises, the first one would be the threat of a nuclear Third Reich, and then the secondary crisis would be the threat of the Soviet Union, and particularly what we identify or what we argue is the real crisis point is the end of the U.S. nuclear monopoly in the 1940s. And so from there, what we do and the way that we talk about scope is understanding, well, what kinds of things happened within government as a direct result of these threats and of the U.S. nuclear program. And so we highlight a variety of different things. There's the creation of multiple different bureaus. So things like the Atomic Energy Commission, and the entanglement of the Atomic Energy Commission with a bunch of different private and public entities, the Federal Civil Defense Administration, and even the Interstate Highway System. That's one area. We look at the creation of a variety of different weapon systems, which are developed explicitly as a response to this nuclear threat. There's also the creation of an expansion of surveillance programs. And so we talk about those types of extensions as well. So these are things which very clearly represent expansions in scope, but are not things that you are going to pick up on a traditional data set.
You could imagine in a sort of unipolar world where one country has lots of nuclear weapons and every other country has zero nuclear weapons, that the scope of that government has increased sort of implicitly, which is to say, we can nuke all of you, better play ball. So in terms of the coercive power of that government, it would seem to increase dramatically.
Yes. So you can certainly make that argument. We're interested not just in thinking about or conceptualizing, and we've highlighted this in our other work as well, not only interactions between officials within the United States government and other governments, but also how these changes have domestic implications as well. And so even though we don't necessarily discuss that as much in this paper, a lot of the policies and agencies that come online in this period, and then the agencies that replaced them, are things that people today would know. And a lot of the regulations and other policies that we are beholden to are coming out of this period.
Put on rails our understanding of the growth of government, that is looking beyond merely this fiscal dollar figure that we see. This is how much is extracted from taxes. This is how much the government spends. What does that give us? What are we learning when we start talking about things like scope?
When we start expanding our definition or our analysis of government growth, not to the exclusion of scale, but to the inclusion of scope, we start to understand that these changes in what kinds of activities government is engaged in has very real implications for not only international policy, but also domestic policy and the lives of everyday citizens. And so one of the things that we are really interested in attempting to do in this work and elsewhere is to understand the implications of those changes in scope. So one of the things that we are attempting to do is to really highlight this other dimension of the framework. Because when Higgs talks about the ratchet effect, he is very, very clear that it is not exclusively applicable to changes in scale. And certainly we could think about why scale would be important. The fiscal dimension is important. But when we are thinking about how different government policies and the portfolio of activities in which government is involved impacts our daily lives, those things move well beyond a simple fiscal realm. And so we've highlighted these kinds of cost associated with scope, these non-monetary costs elsewhere. This is an area in which people tend to think about either the cost or they think about the weapons system on its own, but don't think about all of the other things that come along with the development of that weapon system.
Abigail Hall is a professor of economics at the University of Tampa. We spoke last month in Texas. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily podcast wherever you please. And thank you for listening.